Kevin, I got an email recently actually from an American radio station asking if they might please be allowed to use the green majority, and a quite lengthy explanation at the bottom of the email. The meat of the email was saying, you know, we're just a poor community station and we don't have anything we can pay you. And I was thrilled and happy to reply to them and saying, you know what? Believe it or not, I know that we do amazing programming that could easily be seen on the CBC or any major network. As it happens, it turns out that Green Majority is and will always be a free resource for everybody. So you are more than welcome to take it and use it as you wish, as long as you just make sure that you say that it's the Green Majority. So we will soon have an American partner. We may actually already have other American partners, but this is one of the trouble, is that the people keep playing us, and about half of the station we've picked up since I took over from Jordan, Kevin, about half the stations we've added to our syndicate list were ones that I actually found by just doing the occasional Green Majority search in Google.
Right.
People have this terrible problem with, we love you for playing our shows, but can you please tell us you're playing our show, just because we want to help promote you. So if there's anyone else listening, Green Majority is and always will be free public resource. That is the entire point, is that we're here to provide information for free to everyone. Just tell people that you're doing it, including us. So without further ado, though, Kevin, I don't want to take any more of your time. You've got the next, you've got the floor for about 10 minutes now. You want to update us a little bit more on your most recent global warming climate change / climate change.
Well, first I want to take a poke at Joe Oliver, because I can't resist. He's become my favorite politician for saying up is down and black is white. And he's called out James Hansen, climate scientist, NASA scientist and climate researcher.
Not just any, the head of the NASA Space Goddard Institute. He's one of the top scientists there, who originally became interested in climate change because he noticed he was studying other planets and noticed other planets that had basically lost all their atmosphere because of runaway climate change.
Right.
And went, oh, crap, this is what's happening
like
here.
Like Venus, which is, an example of a runaway climate change right beside us. So he's chastised James Hansen for not knowing what he's talking about. He's called out Al Gore for not knowing what he's talking about. Now he's currently chastising the EU for plans in the EU to list Canadian oil as being dirtier than other sources of oil. So Joe Oliver is ranting about this now, and he's saying that the tar sands represents 1/1000th of 1% of global emissions. That's incorrect. I didn't have time to get the right number. I'll have it next week, but that's just incorrect. And see, I would say Joe Oliver is lying, but I think in fact his grasp of the facts is just so poor that he's spreading disinformation honestly.
Well, we have to ask where he's getting his information from, which is largely and demonstrably, you don't need to be a conspiracy theorist to know that the people who give him his information as a public official is consultants, and the vast majority of those people are oil industry
executives. Oh, they're lobbyists. Yeah.
And they're lobbyists. And so I think he can be passed off by simply the only information he has access to is the information that is people coming from people who have an invested interest.
Well, I got a real laugh when he accused the EU classifications as being unscientific, since he's rejected the advice of two prominent since he clearly was rejecting the advice from James Hansen, who's a world-renowned expert on the topic. But the thing is, okay, even if emissions from the tar sands were 1/1000th of 1%, which they're not, Canada produces 2% of world emissions, and the tar sands is a recognizable portion of that 2%. Like, it's way more than 1/1000th of 1%. Even if that were true, the point is not the emissions from extraction, which is bad enough. We're talking about burning the stuff, Joe. It needs to stay in the ground. The extractive process is dirty enough, but you're talking about, it's the third largest proven reserve of crude oil on Earth after Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. And it's dirty, Joe. It's dirty oil. It has a high cost of extraction. And then you extract it solely for the purpose of burning it, and that is the carbon we are worried about, Joe. We don't want to burn. That's the carbon James Hansen is worried about when he says if we burn the tar sands, it's game over for the planet. And Joe Oliver says, but no, it's only 1/1000th of 1%. How could it be game over for the planet? Because we're going to burn the oil, Joe. That's why it's a significant impact to global warming. Okay, I had to get that out. Because, I mean, honestly, Joe Oliver, our Minister of Natural Resources, John Baird, our Minister for Foreign Affairs, and Peter Kent, the shill for the environment, these people have been living in Washington. Like, they make, they, they, they go a couple of times a week down to Washington to lobby for Keystone XL. And
now, I've been, to be fair, Kevin, I've recently visited a friend in Washington, D.C. Hi, Becca, if you're there. But it's beautiful, so I can understand why they'd want to spend a lot of time there, especially during cherry blossoms. It's a really lovely city.
Oh, and the other quote this week that just about made me gag was the parliamentary secretary for the environment minister. I might have her title wrong, but she was going on about, look, the whole world is on an oil-based economy. What we should be doing is pursuing the development of this resource responsibly. Well, you can't responsibly develop more carbon. You just can't responsibly do it. We're at the peak carbon as it is right now, and there's no way to responsibly develop more carbon-intensive technology or energy sources. Which brings me to the point I really want to make. Peak carbon. I called it peak carbon. I think I just invented that term. But it's
it's been labeled Kevin Farmer invented peak carbon. Copy that.
But we talk about tipping points in climate change, and what a tipping point is basically the point where a positive feedback mechanism kicks in and global warming becomes a self-sustaining prophecy. You know, one such feedback mechanism is just water vapor. Water vapor is itself a greenhouse gas, and as the atmosphere warms, it holds more water vapor, and holding more water vapor causes the atmosphere to warm, which causes it to hold more water vapor, and thus you've got this positive feedback mechanism that accelerates global warming. So I don't have so many details on the effects of atmospheric water vapor, although I've come across articles that suggest that it is a significant concern. The one that's always alarmed me is permafrost. There's estimated which is frozen ground that contains enormous amounts of frozen organic matter. Now, the permafrost is thawing around the world, and as it thaws, the organic matter contained in the frozen ground begins to decompose. If it decomposes in the presence of oxygen, which only the top layer is going to do, carbon dioxide is produced. If it decomposes in the absence of oxygen, methane is produced, which is at least 20 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So, you know, since you can expect there happens to be an estimated 1.7 trillion tons of carbon stored in the permafrost. If you release that all, even under the rosy scenario where that all got released as carbon dioxide, that would triple the existing greenhouse gas inventory of planet Earth. I don't mean it would just triple human contribution. I mean it would triple the total inventory, of which human contribution is actually fairly relatively small. Mm-hmm. It's just that we're upsetting the balance with our contribution. It's not that we're overwhelmed. It's not that it's such an enormous contribution compared to the total inventory. We're just upsetting a balance that's existed for a long time. We're talking about, if that all came out as carbon dioxide, tripling the inventory.
So I just want to jump in here because I took a excuse me again, I've had a bad throat today. I did actually take a climate science course, and there's a very, very useful example that my instructor gave me, which is that when you're thinking about the carbon balance, you should be thinking about one of those sinks like they have in hotels, where right near the top there's a drain, right? So if you plug the drain, eventually it will fill up, and then it won't fall onto the floor because there's a drain.
Right.
But the drain is a certain size. So, and that should reflect basically there's always carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but we have a natural system where it naturally comes into the system and it naturally is leaves the system through a variety of functions that would take hours to go through. But the fact in is there's water in, water out. And so mm-hmm. as long as you have a certain amount of water coming out of the faucet, as long as it's less than what's in the hole, or as long as it's balanced with what's in the hole, then we maintain a constant water level. But if you increase the faucet and more water comes in, even though there's still carbon, aka water, coming out that emergency leak hole, if there's more coming in than the size of that hole going out, then we go over and we have a chance for a spill. Yeah. And that's just a really useful way to think about sort of carbon in, carbon out.
Yeah, so to say we're tripling the atmospheric inventory is actually would actually be like a significant global warming event.
So instead of just increasing the faucet, you've taken three entire sinks worth of water and dumping it in all at once.
Exactly.
And we're worried about even a drop getting on the floor, and you want to dump three sinks worth of water into one sink.
Exactly. And the reality is that the majority of that carbon is going to get released as methane, which would amplify the existing greenhouse gas effect by, say, a factor of 40. So, I mean, that's clearly intolerable that, you know, but here's the point. Now, a recent analysis from the Yale Climate Forum that was reported in Mother Jones estimates that the point at which the permafrost feedback mechanism will become irreversible is 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is lower than our international target of 2 degrees Celsius of warming. Right now, the planet has warmed 0.8 degrees Celsius since pre-industrial times. If we turned off all of the emissions tomorrow, we would continue to warm by another degree by the end of this century, which means even if we stopped all anthropogenic emissions tomorrow, like right this minute, if we turned them off now, we would still expect to warm to about 1.8 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times by the end of the century, which is past the tipping point for melting permafrost, which could unleash a tsunami of greenhouse gases, like thoroughly, utterly dwarfing our own contribution. Like if we unleash that, if that genie gets out of the bottle, there's no way to put it back in. And once that process starts, turning off all anthropogenic emissions won't have any effect. And so the tipping point may very well be upon us. In fact, we might be on the wrong side of the tipping point just based on the momentum that the planet has to continue to warm for another, say, 100 years. And if nothing terrifies you, this ought to do it. And I've been agitating, I've been writing letters to every news media outlet I can get my hands on, and they're ignoring the story. I can't get any traction with anyone. And I'm going to invite all of our listeners to take some time today to find, fire off some emails, Google the Mother Jones article, see what you think. And agitate, because if we don't start taking action now, we might very well be the last generation that can.